Senator, thank you so much for your time and spending some valuable moments with the Combined Faith Communities of Australia, a very large group who care deeply, naturally enough, about the position and the rights of Indigenous Australians. Can I ask how you are right now? With the nature of the debate, what impact has it had on you?
Well, let's just say I'm very exhausted. the amount of travel, the energy that's required to get around the country and talk about an issue that's, I think, very personal to me as well. It's definitely, it's taken a lot out of me. But I have to keep going.
Yes.
Yes.
With the headlines being very much focused on the immediate referendum, could you share a little bit with our listeners what the real state of affairs is for people you love and care for in the Indigenous communities around Australia?
Yeah, sure. Well, I guess with my own family, my mother is from the community of Yuendumu. She was born under a tree. Her first language is not English, it's Warlpiri. Predominantly, most of my family are Warlpiri speakers, their first language speakers, as opposed to English, is not their first language. Growing up in a place like Alice Springs, having a lot of contact with the remote Indigenous communities where my family's lived, I've lived firsthand the sorts of issues that they've been confronted with, alcohol and drug abuse, domestic and family violence, circumstances that I've grown up understanding quite well all my life. I mean, I was very lucky to have a very loving family with my parents, but our extended family experienced and still experience, they're some of the most marginalised Australians in the country.
And these are common experiences?
In a place like the Northern Territory, very common. I think, there aren't many Indigenous families that don't have a family member that's, suffering from alcohol, or substance abuse, gambling, some form of addiction, in the Northern Territory also. We have a lot of my family are still very connected to traditional culture and cultural obligations. My mother was supposed to be part of an arranged marriage and become a second wife at the age of 13 when she was younger. So there are elements of traditional culture that still impact my family's lives, much in a very positive way, but there are also elements of our culture that, I guess, do things like accept violence. Like if the wrongdoing, if there's wrongdoing, there's an expectation that cultural payback is applied. Any premature death or illness is thought to be caused through sorcery, and there has to be somebody held responsible and some form of payback, and sometimes that payback involves violence. This is the sort of day-to-day lives that, people live in the Northern Territory.
Given those complex backgrounds, how can faith communities contribute toward drawing the nation together, Indigenous and other Australians?
Well, the faith community has had a lot of influence throughout communities within the Northern Territory. The missionaries provided during the violence of the frontier, the missionaries provided safe haven for a lot of Indigenous groups. So my mother was brought up a Baptist in her community. There are other communities that are in the Lutheran community as well as Catholic. Depends on which community you are from, usually determines your faith, because that, there's been missionaries that have long been involved with those communities as well. And I think it's not acknowledged enough the good work that was done back in the day to not just provide safe haven against the violence of the frontier, but provide the opportunity for Indigenous Australians to become skilled and become part of, the Australian economy as well, and learning those skills into employment and those sorts of things. And there's a lot of work that is done in the faith community throughout the Northern Territory to support Indigenous Australians, because, of course, it comes with those communities and the fact that, obviously, my family and my community are Indigenous, but they're Australians as well, and often Australians in need.
As a vocal opponent of the Voice to Parliament, if it's not going to be this profile of response, what in your recommendation is the way to go?
Well, the way to go as I see it is, well, my biggest concern is I think it's separatism. I believe it's separatism that has brought us to the situation that we're currently confronted with as Indigenous Australians, being treated differently, being treated in some cases like charity cases that, you know, will always require somebody else to scoop in and rescue us when removing our agency and having the ability to stand on our own two feet. But going forward, what I would like to see is, and I'm prepared to roll my sleeves up and get my hands dirty as the Shadow Minister for Indigenous Australians, to look at the structures that currently do exist, because we do have many voices within those structures and bureaucracies. And currently I have a motion on the floor of the Senate, which myself and Senator Karen Little from South Australia, who is also an Aboriginal woman, an Arunda woman, we've drafted this motion because we want to hold an inquiry into land councils, statutory authorities, bureaucracies that receive federal funding and are responsible for improving the lives of marginalised Indigenous Australians. I would like to fix the problem, the system that currently exists, and provide more accountability measures going forward. I just don't think we've done enough of that well enough. And creating a whole new, very expensive bureaucracy and slapping it over the top of all of that that currently exists, I don't believe is the way forward.
The voice has been variously described, and I quote, as powerless or patronising. Others believe it to be an open door to activism and a disruption to all lives across the country.
Mm.
What's your view of what the voice is?
Well, simply put, we don't know what it is. We just don't know, because we don't have a solid proposal that we can hand on heart say that we feel informed enough to say yes to, I believe. If we listen to the proponents of the voice and their arguments, and certainly what's been written in Document 14, which is known as the Uluru Statement, a lot of what exists in there, there's very little in way of suggesting in practical terms how it's going to improve the lives of our marginalised. There are, however, certainly plans or demands for reparations, paying the rent, creating even a separate sort of power, if you like, a separate kind of black parliament or chamber. To me, separatism doesn't work, but attempting to meet the demands of activists continually isn't about supporting our most marginalised, and it hasn't got us anywhere so far in practical terms.
Every voting household around the country received a pamphlet that I'm assuming you contributed to, which had both the yes and no case in. And in the interests of an alternative view, there isn't a statement in the yes side that includes some of the things you just mentioned. How do we divine the difference between facts and non-facts?
Well, there isn't anything really to give us confidence of what this is going to look like, because I mean, I've undertaken the task of questioning the government on the floor of the Senate from 6 o'clock at night till 4 o'clock in the morning to understand better the detail, to understand how people are supposed to be, whether they're elected or whether they're chosen. And what I've been told is that they will be chosen by community members. To me, that concerns me deeply, because I'm also an advocate for against domestic and family violence. And in a lot of small communities, they're controlled quite often by the most aggressive individuals. So if it's suggested that we just leave it up to the decisions of communities in that way, that's just opening a can of worms for conflict. For the most aggressive to eventually take control and end up being the representative. And these are the concerns that are brought to me also by Indigenous people in remote communities, of how this is all supposed to pan out and how two people, we don't know whether they're, you know, for the Northern Territory, it's been proposed, but we don't know until after we've voted yes. It's supposed to be all put together after the fact. I mean, we don't know how two Indigenous people from the Northern Territory are supposed to represent everybody. I mean, you know, I'm related to Pitjantjatjara, Yankunjatjara, Ngaanyatjatjara, Lurja, Aranda, Warlpiri, you know, there's Tiwi up north, so many different groups, and there's already infighting within the structures that exist. So I believe this will just provide more opportunity for that level of conflict, and a lot of Indigenous Australians are concerned for that. And as you know, well, we don't really know what it's supposed to be.
The charge that's been put to the No campaign is, you don't like this, what do you want to do to solve the great gap issues between Indigenous Australians and other Australians? What is your response to that? What does the No campaign stand for?
Sure. Well, lucky for me, prior to coming into the Senate, I headed up the Indigenous Research Program for the Centre for Independent Studies. And what we found was, you know, for me, it's about the starting point has to be from an honest perspective. So the gap doesn't exist between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australia. The gap exists between those who have and those who have not. Now, the further you move away from a capital city, the more marginalised Australians become, everybody. But our most marginalised, and within the Indigenous community, which is 3% of Australians, only 20% of those are in fact marginalised. So the voice is suggesting that we are inherently disadvantaged for no other reason but our race. But there is a really an Indigenous middle class that are doing very, very well for ourselves. The focus shouldn't be on all Indigenous Australians. It should be on those who are marginalised. And what you will find, and what we found in my research, is that the most marginalised are those whose first language is not English, who are still connected to traditional culture and living in regional and remote parts of the country. So what I would do is I would pinpoint where the most marginalised are and focus efforts in terms of priority on them. But ultimately, serve Australians on the basis of need as opposed to race.
It appears, polls are telling us, that the No campaign could well be victorious in the run-up through this referendum. What would be the outcome if that were to be the case? And I'd like to hear from you what your thoughts are if it were to be a yes.
Sure. Well, look, I think either way, I think this is the most divisive referendum we've ever experienced in our nation's history. And so it concerns me either way. It's not going to be a win for anybody, I don't think, whether it's a yes, whether yes is successful or no is successful. And there's going to have to be a lot of work done going forward to bring our country back together. I mean, I haven't seen the issue of race so prominently for some time in our country. So if No gets up, for me as the shadow minister, as I said, I'm trying to kick off a process already of accountability, of understanding where the money is being spent and providing the opportunity for it to be better focused and spent to produce outcomes. That is what I'm pushing for, and that's what I'll continue to push for after the fact. If the yes vote is successful, I will be fighting tooth and nail from the Senate to ensure that there's the least destructive model of what this might be is created. You know, and it's been suggested that we'll all have a say and it's all wonderful. Well, I've been in the Senate, and if you don't have the numbers, you don't have that much influence. So I think it's wrong to suggest that, you know, I will play any significant role. It's at the whim of the government whether they want anyone else other than the Greens who support them to play a role in determining what this might look like. And look, a couple of other points that I want to make on this issue also is that one, and particularly I know there's, you know, a great migrant community here too, and I think for me as an Australian, we have a wonderful shared Australian values that we've all created together, whether we're from the First Peoples, whether we're from the convict class, who are my ancestors also, or whether from the migrant community who've come here more recently. And I can say I'm married to a proud Scozzy, who's a recent Australian, and I would hate to see our country, you know, create classes of people determined by, you know, heritage in this country. I'm dead serious. set against it. And I would not want for someone who's come here more recently to feel as though they're less Australian. So that's, you know, another reason why I can't agree with this. But also that the voice, the entity itself, once constitutionally enshrined, has the constitutional power and right to challenge the executive, which is the parliament, federal parliament, which is state and territory parliaments, local government, which are the departments and the agencies, the bureaucracies, the governor general even. I mean, if they put forward an argument enough where they're not pleased with a draft bill or something like that, they can challenge that in the High Court, which is their constitutional right to do so, which, you know, becomes the dirt in the cogs, you know, slowing Parliament down, and that's concerning if it comes to any issues of, you know, emergency related issues or even, you know, matters that affect Indigenous Australians are everything because we are Australians.
Time is short. I have one last question for
okay.
you. You spoke about division in the process of this referendum.
Mm.
What's your heart for what comes after? How do we re-knit into an Australia of your dreams from here?
Yeah, that's a tough question. I mean, for me personally, I feel like I've been on a journey with this referendum. My hope being somebody who has an Aboriginal mother and a white Australian father and a migrant husband. And I mean, my children, their background is of mixed heritage too. I mean, my kids have got, we've got a blended family, so I've got a stepson and my three sons, and they've got Irish, Scottish, Welsh, English, French, Malay, Indian, a little bit of Chinese, great-great-grandfather from Mozambique. You know, I've said they could probably make a land claim on every continent on the globe, but that's beside the point. Again, for me, it's about bringing us back to our wonderful shared Australian culture and our wonderful shared Australian values. I don't want to see any more guilt politics within our country. I know that the vast majority of Australians have immense goodwill toward Indigenous Australians, and so I see myself railing against guilt politics. The demands of activists to entrench this idea as though Indigenous Australians need to be treated differently to everybody else, when we don't. We've got a wonderful country that provides the opportunity for every Australian to succeed. For our most marginalised, it's about focusing our efforts on them to ensure that they know how to take those opportunities for their lives and understand that they do have choice. As well, and that's a remarkable part of our country.
Senator Numbajimba Price, thank you so much for sharing with the faith communities of Australia.
Thank you so much.